this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Pulte readies massive Del Webb complex. And on the far right side of this article, there's a map showing the proposed Del Webb site, and that'll be described in the article. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Durham. Sales have been so strong at Pulte Group's Carolina Preserve in Amberley, active adult community in Cary, that the national home builder is making plans to build another massive community under its Del Webb brand. Pulte Group, the largest home building company in the Triangle, is targeting 363 acres off Leesville Road in East Durham for a neighborhood that would cater to adults ages 55 and older. Pulte filed a rezoning request in Durham County this week that, if approved, would allow for the construction of up to 4.25 housing units per acre, says Amy Wolf, a planner with the Durham City County Planning Department. Lawrence Lane, Pulte's Raleigh division president, says the company has not yet determined how many housing units the property could accommodate once recreational facilities and open space areas are factored in. It's too early to tell right now, Lane says. We are clearly in the infancy stage. Based on the similar-sized Carolina Preserve metrics, the North Briar Creek community could easily have more than 1,200 homes at build-out. The mostly forested land is located north of the Briar Creek area and near the Durham and Way County line. Pulte Group opened Carolina Preserve off Yates Store Road in 2006 and has since sold more than 850 homes using the Del Webb brand. Most homes are priced between $190,000 and $400,000, with a mix of single-family, townhouses, and multifamily. The community features a 34,000-square-foot clubhouse with a fitness center, heated indoor pool, ballroom, and a stadium kitchen, plus outdoor walking trails, tennis courts, and a 15-acre lake. UNC Healthcare staffs a wellness center in Amberley's Residence Club building. Lane says the 380-acre Carolina Preserve community is still several years away from selling out its remaining 425 home lots, but the company doesn't want to lose any sales momentum. Given the success we've had at Carolina Preserve, we like to continue serving that active adult community, he says. Pulte has more than 50 Del Webb active adult communities in 20 states, but Carolina Preserve is so far its only one in North Carolina. It has three in Atlanta. I think it makes sense, says Jim Anderson, president of Fuller Land and Development in Raleigh, who specializes in land sales around the Triangle for real estate developers and investors. Pulte has proven they have the right formula with Del Webb and done it with more success than anyone else. I see no reason why they couldn't replicate that at a new location. Anderson points out that it still could be 3 or 4 years before the first home could be ready for sale at the Leesville Road site. And now we move down the page, on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This next article, it's in the center of the page. It has a bold red border around it. And inside of that, there's a very large picture of basketball player Scottie Pippen. It's him on the court during a game in one of the old Chicago Bulls games. And then in the upper right-hand corner, there's the headline in bold white print. Hoops face-off, judge says Pippen due $3 million from Leitner and Davis for failed effort to buy Grizzlies. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Durham. Basketball Hall of Famer Scottie Pippen has lost millions of dollars in ill-advised investments since leaving the NBA in 2003. But the courts have been kind to Pippen, and he's now targeting a pair of high-profile Duke basketball stars turned investors for a $3 million refund. Pippen, unbeknownst to most sports industry observers, was one of the silent partners backing Christian Leitner's and Brian Davis's ambitious $252 million bid to buy the Memphis Grizzlies NBA team in 2006. When that deal went sour, Pippen called the loan. Leitner and Davis, known locally for their Blue Devil Partners real estate company and the redevelopment of Durham's West Village complex, as well as for their contributions to Duke University's men's basketball championship titles in 1991 and 1992, paid back $1.75 million of Pippen's $3 million investment, according to Illinois court documents. Now, a Lake County, Illinois judge has ruled that Leitner and Davis owe Pippen another $2.55 million to cover the balance of the loan, plus an agreed-upon 12% in interest payments. Pippen, as a flamboyant sidekick to North Carolina native and UNC Chapel Hill hoop star Michael Jordan, helped the Chicago Bulls win six NBA championships. He lives in Highland Park, Illinois. A copy of a summary judgment was filed in Durham County in September because Leitner and Davis still own property in Durham and have yet to repay Pippen, says Pippen's lawyer, Jeffrey Katz, of the Spellmeyer and Summer Law Firm in Chicago. Scotty's not looking for anything extra. He just wants his money back, Katz says, adding that a similar complaint has been filed in Ponte Verde Beach, Florida, where Leitner resides. Davis resides in Washington, D.C. While Pippen and Leitner did play together on the 1992 USA Olympic men's basketball dream team, along with Jordan, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, and Charles Barkley, they were more professional acquaintances than close friends, Kat says. Leitner came to Scotty with the deal, but I don't think Scotty knew Davis. Davis was the point man in the proposal to buy a 70% stake in the Memphis Grizzlies from owner Michael Heisley, but he couldn't find enough investors to finance the deal by a January 2007 deadline. University of Memphis sports marketing professor Dick Irwin, who keeps a close eye on the Memphis sports teams, says he never heard about Pippen's involvement in the Grizzlies buyout deal. It came and went so doggone fast, but I don't remember Pippen being affiliated at all, Irwin says. They always said they had this big timer in their hip pocket, but I thought it was someone in the NFL. Indeed, NFL linebacker Sean Merriman, who was recently signed to play for the Buffalo Bills, filed an affidavit in Maryland in August alleging that one of Leitner's and Davis's companies, BD Ventures, owes him $3.6 million. But that deal was related to stalled real estate projects in Atlanta, Baltimore, and Durham. Leitner's and Davis's affiliated companies, including Blue Devil Partners LLC, Blue Devil Ventures LLC, NFC Development Incorporated, BDV Incorporated, and Ball Street Ventures LLC, face other debt claims and pending litigation in North Carolina, Washington, D.C., Texas, and Florida. Blue Devil Partners owes $85,230 in federal tax liens and $15,000 in North Carolina state tax liens, according to court records. NFC Development Incorporated owes more than $13 million related to plans to redevelop the former Leggett & Myers Chesterfield Cigarette Factory building at Main and Duke Streets in Durham. Illinois investment firm Select Capital Management took over ownership of the Chesterfield building in lieu of foreclosure in February. Since then, Select Capital has worked out a deal to sell the building to another Durham development company, Chesterfield Partners LLC, led by Durham native Josh Parker. Parker, who at one time worked for Blue Devil Ventures as an analyst, successfully lobbied the Durham County Board of Commissioners on November 8 to approve a $65 million recovery zone bond sale that will help finance the $89 million renovation project. Parker says none of the six partners involved in Blue Devil Partners, including Leitner and Davis, are involved in his plans for the Chesterfield building, other than as neighbors and owners of the adjacent West Village properties. Construction work on the Chesterfield building is expected to begin in the first quarter of 2011. It is the third and final phase of West Village. Now, just to the right of that article, this next article runs vertically along the right side of the page, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, McCall's Hand in Capital Deal. Now, this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. And underneath the article, there's a picture of an older man, white hair, sitting down wearing a suit, red tie, holding glasses in his hand. The caption reads, Hugh McCall had interest in two entities involved in deal. One of the clear winners in the proposed $181 million merging Raleigh-based Capital Bank with the Charlotte Private Equity Group would be legendary North Carolina banker and former Bank of America CEO Hugh McColl Jr. On the one hand, it was McColl's investment banking firm, McColl Partners, that was hired by Capital to represent the Raleigh Bank in the negotiations with North American Financial Holdings, NAFH. On the other hand, McColl Enterprise, Falfurrias Capital Partners, is an investor in NAFH. In December 2009, Falfurrias committed cash for a minority stake in North American, helping fuel the investment group's dash to acquire troubled banks throughout the Southeast. Falfurrias, of which McColl is a co-founder, has its offices on the 51st floor of the Bank of America building in Uptown Charlotte. McColl Partners, of which McColl is chairman, is three floors higher on 54. Principals in the deal insist that even though McColl may have had his thumbs in both pies, there was no conflict. "He wasn't in the negotiations," says McColl Partners managing director Charles Welch. "I was the point person. I was the one who lived in Raleigh with the Capital Board while the negotiations were going on," echoes Capital Bank CEO Grant Yarber. "There was no conflict. We even hired another group, the Orr Group, out of Winston-Salem, to go over things to make sure there was no conflict." McColl's assistant at Falfurrias says the former Bank of America CEO, who stepped down from that position in 2001, was unavailable for comment. New CEO for Capital. The deal, which must be approved by Capital shareholders and state and federal regulators, calls for Capital Bank to issue 71 million new shares at a price of $2.55 a share to give NAFH an 85% stake in the institution, with the bank receiving $181 million in return. NAFH CEO R. Eugene Taylor, under whom Yarber once worked during a 12-year stint at Bank of America, would become Capital Bank's new CEO but would continue to live in Charlotte. NAFH is one of only three U.S. private equity groups that have received a so-called shelf charter, essentially pre-approval from all the significant federal regulators, to bid on failed banks, says Beverly Evans of the Office of the U.S. Controller of the Currency. NAFH used the shelf in its first major acquisition move to acquire three faltering banks in Florida and South Carolina. Plans now call for those banks to be given the Capital Bank name, with the four institutions rolled into a single $5 billion total asset commercial banking operation that would be headquartered in Raleigh. Yarber would become president of Capital Bank's current 33-branch footprint. Yarber says he doesn't know what his long-term role will be, but I have every intention of staying on. The size of the new Capital Bank board is yet to be determined, but plans call for it to have either 7 or 11 members. Current Capital Board Chairman Oscar Keller III, a Sanford contractor, would hold one of the spots, as would another current Capital Board member who has not yet been named. Capital Bank's current shareholders would be reduced to a 15% stake in the institution, but there is one provision in the deal that would reward them with a cash premium of 75 cents for every share they own. The premium would kick in after 5 years and would be as high as 75 cents per share only if Capital's now challenged and real estate-dominated loan portfolio holds up over time. "The actual amount could be anywhere from 0 to 75 cents," explains Yarber. "This has been a very creative way of handling the existing shareholders. It is also based on conservative estimates." For example, based on their current holdings, the maximum premium would bring $356,829 to board member Carl Ricker, $71,552 to First Citizens Bank, an institutional holder of Capital shares, and $89,906 to hedge fund operator Jeffrey Gendel, who has already cashed out a majority of his Capital holdings. Getting out of TARP. The deal also calls for NAFH to negotiate Capital Bank's exit from the U.S. Treasury Department's Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. Capital received $41 million from the federal government in exchange for shares of preferred stock in the bank and warrants for shares of common stock. Capital entered the program as a healthy bank, only to see its position deteriorate in the face of troubled real estate loans and two unsuccessful attempts to raise cash by selling shares on the public market. The bank recently received a notice from state and federal regulators to raise more money and review its lending practices. In recent months, Treasury Department officials have been allowing an increasing number of banks in similar condition to cash out of the TARP program at a discount, especially in cases in which banks have found a way to recapitalize themselves. As of July 11, community banks had been allowed to repurchase their shares at an average discount of 66%, according to a congressional oversight report. According to the Capital NAFH agreement, the parties in the deal would seek a 50% discount. And our last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, Girl Scouts Closing Camp Joins Others in Cost Cutting. And this article was written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the dateline of Lewisburg. And on the far left, there's a picture of a sign, kind of a simulated street sign the caption reads, Homestead signs have pointed the way for thousands of girls. The top one points to Lodge one way, tree houses another way, and Teams Challenge Course another way. It's from their campground. The Girl Scouts North Carolina Coastal Pines Council is closing its 110-acre homestead campground in Franklin County with plans to sell the property by the end of the year. The day camp, where thousands of girls have participated in team challenge events, high ropes courses, and campouts since it opened in 1972, was deemed expendable after a two-year study and survey of the council's membership determined that it made financial sense to close the camp. It's a tough decision, says Racine Mitchell Sinclair, CEO of the Girl Scouts North Carolina Coastal Pines Council, based in Raleigh. But in this economic time, we still have to pay insurance for upkeep, maintenance, and repairs, and it's probably the best decision for the whole council. We are trying to be careful with our resources. The North Carolina chapter is not alone when it comes to belt tightening. Late last month, news trickled out that a New Jersey factory that makes uniforms for Girl Scouts of America may be losing its contract because the organization may take the business to China. That would have resulted in a loss of 90 U.S. jobs. But sensing a public uproar, Girl Scout officials quickly announced days later, the uniforms continue to be made in America. The North Carolina Coastal Pines Council owns five other camps in central and eastern North Carolina, including two larger residential camps at Camp Graham on Carr Lake in Vance County and at Camp Mary Atkinson near Selma in Johnston County. Both are less than 30 miles from the homestead. Mitchell Sinclair says the other camps have more than enough capacity to handle any Girl Scout troop activity displaced by homestead's closure. If we didn't have the capacity to absorb this at other camps, we wouldn't be closing it, she says. In 2009, Homestead, with 1,278 participants, had the lowest utilization rate among the six Girl Scouts camps. Unlike most of the other camps, Homestead does not have overnight facilities for week-long summer camp events or options for water activities such as a lake, river, or swimming pool. It employs one part-time ranger. Mitchell Sinclair says that any proceeds from the property sale would be invested in the council's five other camps. Also, nine tree houses that were popular at the homestead property will be moved to one of the other Girl Scout camps. No other Girl Scout camps are in jeopardy of closure, she says. A board of directors task force that was charged with studying the council's property assets was disbanded after the board voted to close Homestead. Harold Keene, president and chief executive of KS Bank in Smithfield and a member of the council's board of directors, served as chair of the Girl Scouts Property and Facilities Task Force. He says the group worked on the proposal for 18 months before making the recommendation to close the camp, but he referred questions to Mitchell Sinclair. I've been real impressed with how the Girl Scouts worked through this, he says. The 110-acre homestead property south of Lewisburg on NC-39 has an assessed value of $432,629, according to Franklin County records. William Parrish, owner of Parrish Realty in Zebulon, says property in that area of the county could fetch between $6,000 and $8,000 an acre if the topography will allow for development. That's an excellent location for development because it is still not that far from Raleigh, says Parrish, who specializes in property sales in eastern Wake County and Franklin County. There's a market for anything if the price is right. In addition to the 155-acre Camp Graham and the 262-acre Camp Mary Atkinson, the Raleigh-based Girl Scouts Council owns and operates Camp Hardy with 95 acres on the Pamlico River near Washington, North Carolina, Camp Pretty Pond in Brunswick County, and Camp Mushanee on 843 acres near Pinehurst. The decision to rest or sell a camp is not made lightly, is not a decision we'd like to make, and is done with vast input, Mitchell Sinclair says. We recognize the importance of our outdoor program and the warm memories all Girl Scouts have of their camping experiences. Nonetheless, at the heart of this decision is what's best for meeting the needs of today's Girl Scouts throughout our 41-county jurisdiction. The Girl Scouts North Carolina Coastal Pines Council serves more than 32,000 girls aged 5 to 17, as well as 9,800 adult volunteers in a 41-county jurisdiction in central and eastern North Carolina. The council had an operating budget of $7.4 million in fiscal year 2009, which was down by 9% from the year before. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, brokers told new era of less is here at local confab. And under that, there's a picture of a man standing outside of a mirrored building wearing a suit. The caption reads, Ed Frisch was among those getting the message. Some sobering news for the commercial real estate industry spilled out at the annual ULI Real Estate Trends event on November 9. Developers and investors need to accept the new era of less. Stephen Blank, an Urban Land Institute senior fellow and capital markets advisor, told a Fletcher Opera Theater crowd of more than 300 commercial and residential development leaders. We don't really need anything new of anything, he said. Housing shows no sign of increases in a number of years. Office space is becoming less essential. Blank was followed by a ULI panel of local leaders talking about market conditions. It included Highwoods Property CEO and President Ed Frisch, Wells Fargo Middle Market Real Estate Group leader Andy Holland, hotel developer Mark Laporte of Concord Hospitality Enterprises, Bell Partners, Investment Services VP Joseph Cannon, Hyde Street Holdings Principal John Healy, and home builder, advisor, and marketing expert Audie Barefoot of Fonville Morrissey and Barefoot. The International Affairs Council on November 19 will recognize Dr. Asad Mamandi as its 2010 Citizen of the World. The award recognizes the North Carolinian who has done the most for the internationalization of the state. Past recipients include Ray Buchanan, Executive Director of Stop Hunger Now, Victoria Haynes, President of RTI International, and former governors Jim Hunt and Terry Sanford. Mamandi is a psychiatrist and philanthropist. The council will present the award to Mamandi at the Umstead Hotel and Spa. Michael Jacobs was a busy man in October. His firm, Chapel Hill-based Jacobs Capital LLC, served as the financial advisor for three North Carolina companies that were acquired during the first week of April. Durham-based trucking firm West Brothers Companies was bought by James Brown Contracting Incorporated. Wilmington Medical Supply Incorporated was purchased by Woodbury Health Products. And Leland-based aerospace equipment maker QRP Incorporated was acquired by Penn Engineering. Jacobs Capital is a small firm, only Jacobs, who also is a finance professor at UNC Chapel Hill. A staffer and four interns worked on the deals. It wasn't easy, says Jacobs, who adds that managing three deals at the same time was the most stressful period he's had in 25 years. That may be true, but Biz pointed out that it also meant plenty of tasty celebratory closing dinners as well. I'll host those all day long, agreed Jacobs. Are you friends with Gary Bettman? Plenty of hockey fans are. The National Hockey League says its Facebook page has surpassed the 1 million fans mark. That's bound to make Bettman the league commissioner. Howard McLeod, a UNC Chapel Hill professor who holds appointments in the schools of pharmacy and medicine and at the Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, is adding another hat, this one on the business side. McLeod has been named chief scientific advisor to Gentris Corporation, a Morrisville company that develops tests that gauge a drug's effectiveness based on a person's genetics. McLeod remains director of UNC's Institute for Pharmacogenomics and Individualized Therapy, but will spend additional time at Gentris, says CEO Rick Williams. Biz always loves it when the kids come together to do something cool and good. That will be the case on Saturday, November 13, when more than 200 high school youth from across North Carolina gather at the Crabtree Valley Marriott in Raleigh for the 5th annual North Carolina Youth Giving Summit. Titled The Voices of Giving, the kids will make preliminary decisions on how and where $75,000 will be allocated to help their communities. The funds were donated by philanthropic organizations across the state. Final decisions on how to spend the money will take place in individual communities later in the year. The summit draws youth and adults from more than 25 counties, including Wake. Bob Friedman, one of the founders of the Red Hot and Blue barbecue chain, is getting back into the food business. He and his wife Robin have signed on as franchisees and will open 4 locations of the East Coast Wings and Grill in the Triangle. East Coast Wings is a restaurant group based in Winston-Salem that has been growing rapidly in the Triad and in small towns across the state. There now are 35 locations, generating $55 million in sales. Friedman says he hopes to open the first East Coast Wings location in the Cary or Morrisville area by the spring. Friedman adds it's the latest concept to the family-friendly Red Hot and Blue brand that he helped build from its founding in 1991 until he sold the company in 2006. He still has ownership in a franchise location in Annapolis, Maryland. Until recently, Friedman was the publisher of Business Leader Media, but he says he severed that relationship. Call it the Big Shred from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. in Cary on Saturday, November 13, when citizens can bring in paper and plastics that aren't appropriate for curbside recycling bins. Think of those boxes of canceled checks you don't want to throw in the trash or recycling bin. Bring them. They'll be securely shredded. Also to be disposed of are rigid plastics such as flower pots, nursery trays, lawn furniture, and the like. It'll all happen at the Garmin Operations Center, 400 James Jackson Avenue, in Cary. And if it's electronics you need to get rid of, Fox 50 is teaming up Saturday with Creative Recycling Systems for the TV station's annual e-cycling event. End-of-life electronics can be taken to Rex Healthcare's 4 locations in Raleigh, Cary, Knightdale, and Wakefield to be disposed of in an environmentally beneficial fashion. The free event runs from 8 a.m. to noon at the 4 Rex hospitals. Just days after being put on Preservation Durham's Places in Peril list, the historic McPherson Hospital may have new life. It was feared that Concord Hospitality Enterprises of Raleigh would demolish the 84-year-old structure, but word now is that Concord may retain the exterior of the old hospital at its current location or move it to a lot at Main Street and Buchanan Boulevard, according to a report in the Herald Sun of Durham. Now open at Centrum Station near Crossroads Shopping Center in Cary is the first North Carolina franchise of The Barbershop, which bills itself as a hair salon for men. This is not Floyd The Barbershop. The waiting room offers a flat panel TV, free salted peanuts and coffee. Once in the chair, customers are given a remote control for their personal HD TV. And best of all, standard cuts are $11.50, reduced to $11 if paid in cash. The North Carolina Department of Transportation is going high-tech to keep motorists informed about road work. The department is putting together a weekly video podcast called NCDOT Now that will provide information about transportation projects, safety efforts, and initiatives to protect the environment. The podcast is posted each Monday at www.ncdot.gov and is available for free via iTunes. Normally, donors are rewarded for their efforts with names put on buildings or rooms or plaques, but two Ivy League institutions have found a different way to encourage donations. Shame. Cornell and Dartmouth universities have started circulating lists of seniors who have not yet donated to the class gift. At Dartmouth, just one student chose not to donate and was subjected to editorials condemning her in the student newspaper and to her photo being posted on a blog. Biz's reaction? Downright rude and Bush League, not Ivy League. SideQuest CEO Steve Y is a known pinball enthusiast, and the Carey Company's break room has a couple of machines that we services himself. When Biz asked what the company plans to do with all the extra space it's adding, SideQuest recently increased the amount of space it leases to 45,000 square feet. We joked that the space is for more pinball machines. What would investors think of that? Biz wondered. Oh, they won't know because you won't tell them, he said. Well, Steve, now they know. Explorers Middle School 8th grader Rebecca Evans has been selected to represent her school and her city during Time Warner Cable's nationwide interactive online town hall broadcast of Math, Science, and the Future of Our Nation, a program that will be hosted on November 17 by former Vice President Al Gore. Time Warner Cable will host a viewing party at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh, one of 16 nationwide. The purpose is to encourage students to work hard to develop proficiencies in math and science. Time Warner picked Evans to ask a question directly to the panelists, including Segway inventor Dean Kamen and astronaut Sally Ride. Evans is editor of her school's yearbook and captain of the girls' soccer team, and she also has interned at the Natural Sciences Museum, working with the Tropical Conservatory and Mobile Reptile Unit. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, James Gallagher, Frank Van Leeuwen, and Chris Basden. And now we return to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first article we come to has the headline, Scary Precedent Could Belt Universities. This article is written by James Gallagher with the Dateline of Raleigh. The area's research universities are counting on the U.S. Supreme Court to ensure that the flow of millions of dollars in tech transfer revenue is not stopped. The court has agreed to hear a case between Stanford University and drug maker Roche Holdings AG, the outcome of which could alter the way universities capitalize on the research conducted on their campuses and redefine who receives the payment for inventions. The case hinges on whether Stanford or Roche owns the patent to an AIDS treatment developed by Stanford researcher Mark Holney. Leaders of the Triangle Universities are banking on a ruling in Stanford's favor. Anything else could cause heartburn for them. The precedent here is scary, Bob Tabor, Vice Chancellor of Corporate and Venture Development at Duke University, says of the potential outcome. Tabor adds that anything other than a ruling in Stanford's favor could put a cloud over university-created research by making it harder to license. Universities often license discoveries, and those licenses generate revenue for the institutions. While the dollars are not frequently large, Duke receives between $15 million and $20 million annually, there is always the potential for a discovery to become a blockbuster. New York University, for example, took in more than $791 million in 2007 licensing revenue when it sold its interest in a drug for $650 million. Universities were given the right to claim ownership of discoveries made during federally funded projects by the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980. At issue in the Stanford case is that while Holodny was working at Stanford, he also had a side contract with a company called Cetus and gave the rights to his treatment discovery to Cetus, which is now owned by Roche. Stanford sued for patent infringement, claiming that because the research was funded by federal dollars, the Bayh-Dole Act gave the university the rights to the discovery. A federal appeals court ruled in 2009 that Stanford had no grounds to sue because Holodny had already assigned the rights to Cetus. Now the Supreme Court will decide the matter. Patent law generally stipulates that the rights to any invention lie with the creator. That is why employers, including private research institutions and frequently universities, require researchers to sign away those rights. The Bayh-Dole Act was intended to assign the rights of federal research to universities, but the language of the act isn't perfect, says Artie Rye, a patent law professor at Duke University. The language isn't crystal clear, but the legislative history is pretty suggestive, he says. University tech transfer offices largely operate under the assumption that Bayh-Dole explicitly gives them rights to any discoveries and trumps standard patent laws. Kathy Inns, director of UNC Chapel Hill's Office of Technology Development, says Stanford is arguing that researcher Holodny had no right to sign away the rights to his findings. Adds Billy Hotelling, director of NC State University's Office of Technology Transfer, all faculty members assign the rights to their work to the university through their employment contract. Still, the concern over a ruling in Roche's favor could give credence to the argument that traditional patent law trumps the Bayh-Dole Act, and as a result, private companies would be reticent to license university technology if it remains unclear who holds the rights. The U.S. Solicitor General has filed a brief in support of Stanford, and Ray says the Supreme Court has sided with the Solicitor General about 80% of the time. Still, with the rightward bent of the court and growing support of corporations, this decision could go either way. There is some ambiguity to this case, Ray says. And our next article is written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Greensboro. The headline, Swofford's pay hiked by 89%, now at $1.7 million. Atlantic Coast Conference Commissioner John Swofford was given an 89% pay raise to $1.68 million in the 2008 to 2009 fiscal year, making him the third highest paid league honcho in the country. ACC tax documents show that Swofford received base compensation of $1.47 million, deferred compensation of $185,500, and other compensation of $21,134 for the fiscal year ended June 30, 2009. Tax documents from the previous year, which had different compensation breakdown headings, show that the commish took home a total of $888,116. That included $518,022 in what was labeled compensation, $314,399 in contributions to employee benefit plans and deferred compensation plans, and $55,695 in expense accounts and other allowances. The ACC responded to an inquiry about the increase with an emailed statement from Associate Commissioner Jeff Elliott that said, Commissioner Swofford reports to the Council of Presidents, which is represented by the CEO from each of the 12 member institutions. This group solely determines commissioner's compensation package. Boston College President William Leahy currently serves as the chair of the ACC's Council of Presidents. Leahy says Swofford had a couple of deferred compensation plans the conference arranged for him several years ago. A change in a federal tax law prevented Swofford from rolling the packages over again, which resulted in the compensation bump that year. That was a one-time increase in his overall compensation, Leahy says. Leahy declined to say how much compensation Swofford would receive in the current fiscal year. Even with the increase, Swofford trailed the Southeastern Conference's Michael Slive and the Big Ten's James Delaney in compensation during the 2008-2009 fiscal year. Slive was tops at $2.1 million, while Delaney brought in about $4,000 more than Swofford. The ACC commissioner did best his counterparts in the remaining three major conferences. Big 12 Commissioner Dan Beebe's compensation totaled $661,898, while the Big East Michael Trangisi took home $600,028. Former Pac-10 Commissioner Thomas Hansen had total compensation of $588,049 that year. Leahy says the council wants Swofford to be paid competitively in regards to other commissioners. He says council members look at a number of other factors when determining Swofford's pay, the amount of revenue the league generates, how Swofford represents the conference nationally, the way he works with presidents and athletic directors, and Swofford's longevity. Swofford oversees a conference that generated nearly $173 million in revenue during the 2008 to 2009 fiscal year, and he recently negotiated a new television deal that should boost the league's revenue in years to come. Their job is to generate revenues for their member institutions, Chad McAvoy, an associate professor of sports management at Illinois State University, says of conference commissioners. But are the commissioners worth the big bucks they're paid? Smith College economics professor Andrew Zimbalist doesn't think so, explaining that the reason so much money matriculates to commissioners and college coaches is because the labor pool, college players, aren't paid. Our next article, Inside the Triangle Business Journal, is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with the dateline of Research Triangle Park. The headline, Bolognese Back in the Lab, Ex-Trimeris Chief Head Startup That Snared $5.7 Million. And above this article, there's a picture of a man sitting in a lab with a lab coat on, sitting at some machines working. And the caption reads, Bruce Sullinger is the director of B3 Bio. And then within the article, there is a face shot picture of a man. It's CEO Danny Bolognese, and we'll hear more about him in the article. Durham Pharmaceutical Company, B3 Bio, has no offices of its own, nor does the company even have a website. But the 10-employee startup now has $5.7 million in equity financing that it can use to develop medicines that more precisely target individual cells and tissues. B3 Bio disclosed the financing, more than two-thirds of the $8.8 million targeted in the round, in a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The company, whose technology is licensed from Duke University and the University of Texas, is led by co-founder and CEO Danny Bolognese, who was a co-founder and CEO of Mooresville AIDS drug company Trimeris. B3 Bio operates from the accelerator at the Research Triangle Park location of the Hamner Institutes for Health Sciences. The Hamner takes an equity stake in companies that are accepted into the accelerator. Besides the current equity round, B3 Bio was recently awarded a $244,479 federal grant for work on targeted delivery of nucleic acids to silence cancer genes. Bolognese did not respond to multiple messages seeking comment, but the company has found parties interested in its work. In January, the company announced an agreement with Roche that calls for B3 Bio to develop technologies for the Swiss pharma giant. The deal gives Roche rights for further development and commercialization of the resulting technologies. The companies also said that as part of the agreement, Roche would increase its equity investment in B3 Bio and provide development funds. Specific financial terms weren't disclosed, but Bolognese said at that time, that the deal continues an existing relationship with Roche. B3 Bio's board includes Lee Babbis, former president and director of pharmaceutical research for Roche. Jessica Canning, global research director for Dow Jones Venture Source, says investments in healthcare have been soft compared to other sectors because venture investors in healthcare rely on initial public stock offerings as exits before they can make new investments. But she says that for the right company, investors will invest. If there is a good company, they will absolutely invest in it right away, she says. But we're not seeing a steady flow of deals right now. At the time the Roche deal was announced, Bolognese said B3 Bio is, quote, ideally positioned to work with academia to identify promising emerging technologies, unquote. The academic collaboration could come through Duke, where Bolognese once taught, and where B3 Bio director Bruce Sullinger still teaches. Sullinger runs a research laboratory at Duke focused on investing and developing novel therapeutic agents. He also serves as a professor of surgery and chief of the Division of Surgical Sciences at the Duke University Medical Center and is director of the Duke Translational Research Institute. Sullinger did not return messages seeking comment. But in a March interview, he told Triangle Business Journal that Roche could use B3 Bio's technology in its R&D work to evaluate new therapies. It's a way for them to, in a sense, test the waters, he said. Bank regulators ponder okay for peer-to-peer lender. That's the headline on our next article. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. LendingClub.com, a Redwood City, California-based peer-to-peer lender that pays interest to investors out of interest collected from borrowers, says it wants to do business in North Carolina, but it may not be able to do so. State banking regulators are looking to see whether LendingClub.com is exempt from the licensing requirements of the state's Consumer Finance Act. It's accurate to say that we are looking into the matter, says Ray Grace, Deputy Commissioner of North Carolina's banks. At this point, the venture-backed consumer lending firm holds no license from the Banking Commission to do business in the state. At issue is the legal question over whether the company's ties to a Utah-based industrial bank exempt it from having to obtain such a state license, Grace says. Right now, we don't know the answer to that, he adds. Started in 2007 as an alternative to banks, LendingClub.com uses a web-based platform to connect people seeking consumer loans with investors seeking interest returns by funding those loans. In 3 years, LendingClub.com says it has funded nearly 18,000 unsecured auto, home improvement, business, consolidation, and other sorts of loans with a starting APR of 6.78%, valued at $172 million, but none were in North Carolina, which the company has said was one of 10 states where it wasn't doing business. That changed on October 28 when the firm issued a press release stating that it was opening its electronic platform to creditworthy loan seekers in North Carolina. Asked what had changed, company spokesman Nate Purpura says that since going through a quiet period in 2008 when it was registering with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, LendingClub sought to be licensed in every state and was just now getting around to North Carolina. Asked to elaborate on the North Carolina licensing process, Purpura said another LendingClub official would have to respond, but none did. LendingClub is registered with the SEC because the prospective loan contracts it offers to investors essentially are securities. Loan applications, along with a borrower's credit score and other information, are offered in SEC filings as notes. Perusing the notes, investors can decide whether to buy the interest income on a particular loan. The company says the returns for investors average 9.67%. LendingClub's website identifies WebBank, which is chartered as an industrial bank and based in Salt Lake City, as its partner. WebBank executive Barrett Hicken was not available for comment. Industrial banks are niche banking players set up to raise money by selling investment shares and using those proceeds to make loans. LendingClub is not the only peer-to-peer player, or P2P player. First out of the gate back in 2006 was another California firm, Prosper, which says it has garnered more than 1 million members and made $208 million in consumer loans in 4 years. Spokeswoman Anna C. says Prosper accepts borrower applications from North Carolina but doesn't enroll investors from the state. Now, our next article, written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh, has as a headline, "Even without funding, RHA begins Walnut Terrace remake." And within this article, there's a picture, a large picture of a man in coat and tie standing in the middle of the street outside of the Walnut Terrace buildings. And in the corner of that picture, there's a map showing exactly where it's located in Raleigh. The caption reads, RHA Executive Director Steve Beam has an alternative plan if Hope 4 funds don't come through. And that's 4 in Roman numerals. Demolition crews soon will begin tearing down the crime-ridden Walnut Terrace housing project on the south side of downtown Raleigh, even though federal funding for redevelopment has not been approved. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has rejected the Raleigh Housing Authority's request for $22 million in Hope 4 grants four times. And excuse me, it's Hope 6, and the 6 is in Roman numerals. Hope 6 is a program in which communities are granted money to redevelop severely distressed public housing projects across the country. Hope 6 funds have been used over the last 10 years to redevelop Raleigh's Chavis Heights and Halifax Court, now known as Capitol Park, into mixed-income communities, including those with incomes below the poverty line. RHA Executive Director Steve Beam says he plans to submit a new application for Walnut Terrace to HUD by a November 22 deadline, but competition is expected to be stiff for the $124 million available for the 2010 fiscal year. A decision is expected to be announced in May or June. It is down to the wire now, Beam says. The last residents at Walnut Terrace moved out on November 10, and RHA has been working over the past few months to find new housing for them. Beam says the authority is seeking bids for a demolition contractor to begin tearing down the 300 units in the 1950s-era barrack-style buildings in January. The J. Davis Architects firm in Raleigh has put together a design for the 27.5-acre Walnut Terrace complex that includes a mix of townhouses, villas, single-family houses, an apartment-style senior housing building, and a community center. A revamped Walnut Terrace, which is near the intersection of Fayetteville Street and Martin Luther King Boulevard, would offer HUD-financed public housing, housing finance agency regulated tax credit financing, or affordable market rate housing. Affordable market rate housing is available to people who earn 80% or less than the area's median average income. All three types of housing are available at RHA's redeveloped Capitol Park and Chavis Heights properties. If RHA is unsuccessful in winning a Hope 6 grant this time around, Beam says the authority has an alternative plan in place to fund the estimated $50 million construction project. But he says the project would be smaller and take longer to build without Hope 6 support. To raise money, RHA is preparing to sell 104 single-family homes it has purchased around the city since 1997. That is expected to generate enough income to build 148 public housing units at Walnut Terrace. RHA also is prepared to sell two duplex properties on Ellington Street, an unoccupied office building at 420 North Boylan Avenue, and an RHA maintenance and warehouse facility at 101 Authority Lane. Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen says the city, which has no governing authority over RHA other than appointments to its board of directors, has been impressed with RHA's national record for on-time, on-budget completion of Hope 6 redevelopments. City officials have agreed to continue staffing its community center and donate 2 acres adjacent to the Walnut Terrace property to enlarge its footprint for development. Their purpose is to provide some really first-class affordable housing for people, and these Walnut Terrace facilities need to be replaced, Allen says. An added benefit for us is that it is so close to downtown, it's a great location with access to the bus lines and employment opportunities that adds to the value of the project. Residents living near Walnut Terrace are anxious for the redevelopment to move forward. The legacy buildings at Walnut Terrace do not provide adequate living conditions, says Jason Hibbets, chair of the Southwest Citizen Advisory Council. The plan for a mixed-income housing community will have a positive economic impact beyond the boundaries of that project. It can potentially spur new development and positive infill in the surrounding areas, while at the same time providing some density, more density, close to downtown. For unfulfilled projects, state takes back 97% of grants. And that's the headline on this article written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. State officials say they've clawed back all but 3% of $3.09 million in cash incentive grants paid to companies that closed operations or canceled hiring or investment plans in the state. The money was paid to 13 companies from the state's three premier corporate incentives programs, One North Carolina, the Jobs Development Investment Grant, or JDIG, program, and the Green Business Fund. Five of the firms ended up closing down their operations, while eight companies terminated the projects for which they had been receiving the state cash, according to a new report submitted by the State Department of Commerce to the General Assembly. Only three concerns, Boatmaker Chris Kraft, Headway Corporate Resources, and IWCO Direct, still owe the state money on incentive agreements, the report says. As of October 1, the trio owed total paybacks of $92,360. The numbers reflect corporate payouts and repayments since 2007, the year the Commerce Department began making clawbacks for non-performance on incentives deals, says Department spokeswoman Kim McCarl. And we'll stop there with the article as the rest of it goes into more detail on what the businesses, each business that owes money did. Instead, we'll read from a graph that is titled, Hey, Pay Up. Three companies that didn't deliver as promised still owe the state thousands of dollars. And it lists the three companies. Chris Craft paid $54,212, has repaid $13,552, still owes $49,660. Headway Corporation paid $50,175, has repaid $40,140, and still owes $10,035. And IWCO Direct paid $93,750, has repaid $52,083, and still owes $41,667. And for our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Capital Bank gets new CEO, board members. Raleigh-based Capital Bank will get a new CEO and a restructured board of directors in a financial transaction that will see a Charlotte private equity group pump $181 million into the Triangle lender. North American Financial Holdings Incorporated, NAFH, set up by former Bank of America Vice Chairman Gene Taylor, will acquire 85% of Capital stock in the deal. Taylor will take over as Capital CEO, and NAFH's Christopher G. Marshall will become CFO. Current CEO Grant Yarber and CFO Michael R. Moore are expected to remain in senior executive roles at the bank. Ira David Wood III won't play Scrooge this year. Say it ain't so, David. Actor Ira David Wood III will not be performing in this year's version of the annual production A Christmas Carol. Because of medical conditions, Wood III will not be in the role of Scrooge for the first time since he first wrote, staged, and starred in the show 35 years ago. Wood's son, Ira David Wood IV, will take over the lead role of Scrooge, confirms the Christmas Carol program marketing director Brent Simpson. Wood IV and his sister, Hollywood actress Evan Rachel Wood, will co-direct the production, which will be performed December 3rd through 5th in Durham and December 8th through 11th in Raleigh. Ex-GSK lawyer charged with obstruction. A former GlaxoSmithKline associate general counsel was charged in federal court in Boston with obstruction and false statements in connection with an investigation into the promotion of a prescription drug. Lauren Stevens of Durham was charged with one count of obstructing an official proceeding, one count of concealing and falsifying documents to influence a federal agency, and four counts of making false statements to the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Justice announced. Stevens faces a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison for each obstruction charge and 5 years in prison for each false statement charge. The DOJ alleges that Stevens provided misinformation to the FDA after the agency contacted Glaxo in October 2002 as part of a probe into possible marketing of a GSK drug for off-label uses. While physicians sometimes prescribe drugs for uses other than those for which they have been approved, companies selling the drugs are barred from encouraging those applications. Mebane's Tanger Outlet Center draws 150,000 for opening weekend. More than 150,000 people are estimated to have trekked to Mebane for the grand opening of the Tanger Outlet Center during the three-day weekend that ended Sunday, Tanger spokesman Mike Boucher said. That's in the ballpark of what we're anticipating, Boucher says. We were expecting a big turnout and we weren't disappointed. The Tanger Outlet Center of Mebane opened on November 5 with all 78 of its retail shop spaces filled at the 317,000-square-foot center. The outlet mall is located in Mebane at exit 154 on Interstate 40 between Chapel Hill and Burlington. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.